In word and deed, compassion. Today's sermon is an opportunity to zoom in on one short phrase among the core values drafted by our congregation through collaboration over the last 6 months. And as any good layperson's sermon begins, it will begin with a disclaimer. This is not my greatest virtue. In fact, on the way here this morning, someone crossed Pickett from the post office, you know, down Pickett Lane, a really long sedan, and sat in the median. And my thought was, you dope, you know? But how many times have I been there thinking I could make it across all four lanes or what have you? So I confess that this sermon is something of an exploration for me. Though compassion is only one word among 260 words in this short document, the sentiments it contains are worth exploring more. In the word compassion, we are defining in part what it means to extend Christ's love, the ideal which we have listed first among our core values, extending Christ's love. In my time with you today, I will explore compassion as a word, and then I will explore the complexities of compassion as a deed. What is the meaning of compassion? What does compassion look like in action? And most importantly, what does compassion look like when it is an expression of Christ's love? First, compassion defined. A feeling of deep sympathy and sorrow for another who is stricken by misfortune, accompanied by a strong desire to alleviate this suffering. According to this definition, compassion is a feeling. The Latin root of compassion, I'm wondering if Ella is here because I know she knows some Latin. I don't know if I'm going to say this properly. Compati means suffer with. Now, I am no etymologist, but Google is an excellent collaborator. Perhaps you know that Google Books aims to create a comprehensive, searchable virtual card catalog of all books in all languages. I'm not sure some of the young people know what a card catalog is, but it's searchable. Lots of books. One nifty outcome of this project is that we can search the prevalence of any word over time in their collection of books. And we can look at the results in the form of a line graph, which shows the percentage of the word's use among all words at a given time. This makes me nerdily excited. This search yielded fascinating results for the word compassion. From the 1500s to the present, peak use of the word compassion occurred in 1806, which might come as no surprise to fellow literary nerds. That is kind of at the height of the Romantic period. Now, what year might you guess is the low point for the word compassion in the English language over the last 500 years? Well, the year was 1944, the year of the deadliest battles of World War II, a year of great suffering, and the year with the least frequent use of compassion in the written word in modern history. Now, compassion means to suffer with. Since that time, I have some good news. The use of compassion has steadily increased to the present day, with compassion regaining one-third of its prominence in the written word since 1806. Perhaps this trend offers us some hope for a more compassionate future. Now, with these facts and figures said, I suspect that compassion as a word alone pales in comparison to Joseph's story of compassion, as Harry read today, compassion in action as described in Genesis 45. After the betrayal of his jealous brothers who sold him into slavery, Joseph had become the most powerful leader in Egypt, second only to Pharaoh. In Genesis 45, we witness the cathartic resolution to Joseph's suffering in a scene of forgiveness and compassion. Joseph says, "Come close to me. God sent me ahead of you to save your lives by a great deliverance. It was not you who sent me here, but God." His brothers, perhaps on the verge of starvation, were at the mercy of the brother whom they betrayed. And Joseph chose not only to forgive, but to save their lives. Now, my initial reading of this chapter left me in awe of Joseph's compassion in the midst of his pain. To think that he desired to alleviate their suffering despite the suffering that they inflicted on him. Now, my next reading led me to a few questions. If Joseph were still suffering himself, if he had not gained power and security and prominence, would he have shown mercy to his brothers? Or was his miraculous rise to power the thing that gave him the clarity to forgive? Furthermore, in the preceding chapters, we see that compassion was not Joseph's first step toward forgiveness. Beforehand, he punished his brothers with fear and trickery, pretending not to know them when they arrived in Egypt, accusing them of espionage, holding them in custody, and threatening their lives. There were definitely some games played before compassion was in action. Joseph's choice to save and forgive his brothers is no doubt moving and virtuous and something to aspire to. But God intervened in his suffering and compensated him with power, prosperity, a new family. In fact, his children's names that are described in previous chapters make clear his sense of restoration. Manasseh, which means God made me forget all my trouble and my father's household. And Ephraim, which means God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. Though the pain and betrayal and loss endured, he had a rise to power that made the bigger picture of redemption clear. So, I wonder, when we describe compassion as a core value that enacts Christ's love, is this the kind of compassion that we seek? No doubt the highs and lows of Joseph's experience surpass the everyday challenges that we experience, like trying to cross picket. But is this compassion from a place of power what we seek? Does compassion look like pity to us? I believe that our core value of extending Christ's love invites us into something even more pure and unconditional. Though today's New Testament reading might not provide a story as grand as Joseph's, we do have the message of Jesus directly to the masses who gathered to hear him and be healed. Jesus said, "I say to you that listen, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. If anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from anyone who takes away your coat, do not even withhold your shirt." This is Christ's matchless love, the kind of love that dies on the cross. Love given freely, even to enemies. And here's more. Do this without judgment. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Not only are followers of Christ called to love both our friends and our enemies, we are to offer this mercy without judgment. Marilynne Robinson, a contemporary American author I'm fond of, describes this kind of compassion as something purer and grander than mercy, something that puts aside the consciousness of fault, the residue of judgment, that makes mercy a lesser thing than grace. There's the word I've been looking for. Grace. Limitless, unconditional, without the residue of judgment. That, I believe, is what it means to extend Christ's love. Supposing we take this value seriously, what does it look like to extend Christ's love? To express in word and deed compassion and friendship toward all. Imagine this, a community that puts aside the consciousness of fault, that expresses compassion without the residue of judgment, a community that embodies grace. For me, this core value requires a great deal of humility, a recognition that I must choose compassion day to day, in each interaction, within and beyond these church walls. To conclude, I'd like to share a passage that reminds me of the source, the energy that can sustain our commitment to Christ's love and compassion. I invite you to join me by opening your pew Bibles to page 241. This is 1 John 4:16, about halfway through the verse 16 through verse 21. Again, it's page 241 in our pew Bibles. God is love, and those who abide in love abide in God, and God abides in them. Love has been perfected among us in this, that we may have boldness on the day of judgment, because as he is, so are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not reached perfection in love. We love because he first loved us. Those who say, I love God, and hate their brothers or sisters are liars, for they do not love a brother or sister whom they, for those who do not love a brother or sister whom they have seen cannot love God whom they have not seen. The commandment we have from him is this: those who love God must also love their brothers and sisters. Individually and together, God has given us his Spirit. His love abides in us. Our shared commitment to extend Christ's love comes from the love we have received. What does a commitment to compassion for all look like to you? Give yourself just a moment to imagine one small change. One step that goes beyond the word compassion itself. Did something come to mind? Consider sharing this reflection verbally with someone today, whether at Faith Formation Hour or on your drive home. May God honor our commitment in word and deed and teach us what it means to live out compassion toward all.